Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talkback Gardening. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, gardeners, particularly gardeners that have got a shady courtyard. What a little bit of wow. How about a fern? Fern, you say? They're waterholics. Well, maybe they're not. Maybe we make them waterholics, and there are ferns out there that are not waterholics. We're going to take a look and explore the potential of putting wow in a shady courtyard garden, and the person who's going to do that is Wayne Richards. He's a very, very keen fern grower, and he'll work through, and he's going to talk a little bit about a rabbit's foot fern. Why, that could be the first fern you grow in your courtyard, and we'll use the rabbit's foot fern as an example of how to grow your ferns in containers in shady gardens. Later, citizens' science. We often have questions about soil health, and I often talk about soil health, so does Sophie, but how do you know if your soil is healthy? It's in the soil, it's in, under the ground, you can't see it. So there's a lovely citizens' science program coming the way of particularly people, listeners in the Riverland and Murraylands area, and hopefully it's a pilot. And it's just a very simple little test, how you can actually access this test from the Landscape Board, and you can test your own soil, whether it's vegetables or fruit trees or whether it's cereal crops, whether it's ornamental bush and things like that. A very simple little test, and it'll tell you whether your soil is healthy.
Wonderful. So if you're in the Riverland and Murraylands region, stay tuned for that information because you can be a part of it. And of course, John, you're here to answer people's questions as well, so give us a call on 1300 222 891. If you'd like to make a comment on the text line, we're happy to receive that as well. The text line is 0467 922 891, and if you download the ABC Listen app and make ABC Radio Adelaide your favourite, you can just tap the app and get straight through to us as well that way. And I have two October ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away a little later in the program.
Gardens are becoming smaller. Courtyard gardens are popping up everywhere. But people still want a garden, and they want colour in their garden. Well, green is a colour, and it's a wow plant that could be coming your way in the form of a fern. We're going to talk very, very shortly. In fact, we're going to talk right now to Wayne Richards, who's a very experienced fern grower. So good morning to you, Wayne. I'm getting a little bit
morning,
carried
John.
Away here. Listen, there's a perception out there that ferns are waterholics, and people will often buy a maidenhair fern and they'll pie it with water and it'll die and they're not very impressed. And so they walk away from ferns. There are, I believe, much tougher, durable kind of ferns. Could we just start by looking at the Australian fern and how durable is it in terms of climate?
Actually, they're a lot tougher than we give them credit for. We all think that because they grow up in the tropics around on the coastline, lots of water, that when we grow them here in South Australia, we have to do the same thing. We have to give them a lot of water. Unfortunately, because of their very fine root system, we tend to overwater and they drown. So That's one reason why we just got to be careful of what plants we do actually get.
One presumes that most of the ferns that are accessed via the garden centres are native ferns, so presumably they've learned to thrive in our hot, dry climate.
Yeah, they do. And probably important thing to remember that when you buy a fern, say, from a garden centre, it's come from a nursery that is fed it up fairly well with sort of a not a real strong mix. So when you take it home, one of the first things you should do is repot it with a strong potting mix that obviously you've done some research to find out what would be a good mix for it.
So, all right, well, we'll come back to mixes shortly. But first of all, the maidenhair fern. Tell us why probably your first fern shouldn't be a maidenhair fern.
Probably the main thing is overwatering. We tend to think that they've got to be watered, and if it happens that there's a couple of you in the house, every time you walk past it, you think, oh, I'll give it a little drink. The position is another strong one. You want to try and keep it away from any position where it gets strong winds. That will damage it pretty quickly, and it also dries out your mix. You need reasonably bright light to make it survive. The potting mix could be an issue. Some ferns need an acid mix, some need a lime mix. And another big issue that comes around is we tend to overpot. We buy a plant at the nursery and we take it home and we put it into a much larger pot.
Interesting. Okay. And
the
again,
biggest problem there is because it's a bigger pot, a lot more surface area, holds a lot more water.
Yes.
And that's where the troubles begin.
Yeah, the mix just stays too wet for too long.
That's right,
again,
yes.
I'd like to drill down to some of those points in a bit more detail shortly, but nothing succeeds like success. And I said to you during the week when we were having a chat about a fern, pick out a fern you reckon that's a real winner, that should be the first fern that people buy, maybe, but it's going to have to be attractive, have a wow factor, and you mentioned a fern called a rabbit's foot fern. Give us a picture of a rabbit's foot fern.
A rabbit's foot fern, hare's foot fern, squirrel's foot, they have long, furry rhizomes that will wander over the pot. I know in Japan they train them up into shapes. If you were to put a wire sort of a shape into your pot, you could train them up into that. They're quite hardy and they're cold resistant. They will shed their fronds each year. Some will shed all the fronds and others only partially.
Aha, but when the ferns drop, you've got these lovely little silver little ferns, little feet all over the top of the container or all around the hanging basket and things like that. They look very, very attractive even then.
They do. And some varieties will have a silver foot, and others are a brown or a grey colour sort of a silver foot that wraps itself around the basket.
I'm just looking at a picture of one at the moment, Wayne. It's hanging in a round basket and it's just this beautiful round ball of green colour. It looks sensational.
They really are, yes. And the important thing is, A, they look like a fern. They've got a real fern leaf on them, and the fact that they are extremely hardy. Would that be correct?
They are. You don't have to worry too much about the repotting because depends what you grow them in. You can either grow them in a wire basket with a liner or you grow them in normal plastic pots. They do weave their way around. As I said, over the years, they will fill that basket, and it depends on you whether you want to repot, and that's another thing that we'll talk about.
Absolutely. So you mentioned you can either stick them in a basket or a plastic pot, and I would presume as a fern grower, a very dedicated fern grower, you probably would go for the basket rather than plastics. What's wrong with plastic?
Plastic is good, but depending on the type of rhizome that the fern will have, some of the ferns you can have, I've got a favourite one called Fiji Entis, but that's different again. But if you have the wire basket, the rhizomes run around that. If you've got a plastic pot, sometimes the rhizome will bury itself down into the pot and you don't see it.
Yeah, that's right, unless they sort of spill over the side.
Yeah.
So location, getting the location right. Where you've got a shady garden, a courtyard, and maybe it gets a pretty good light, and maybe on one side there's sun and the other side is shade, getting the right location.
Preferably, everything you read and what they tell you, they like an easterly aspect. So morning sun,
yep.
Shade in the afternoon.
Right.
My place at the moment, I get afternoon sun. But because I've got a shade house, I'm able to protect it. But the main things is for the location, as I said before, is a shaded area. Make sure that you're not getting any draft or winds, because sometimes down the side of a house, the wind will rush down there, and if you don't know, on a hot day, that hot wind will just really destroy your plants. So you just need to be careful of those sort of situations.
You mentioned shade. I can't let you go without asking you about, if you're going to use shade cloth, what kind of shade cloth would you use?
I use 70% beige shade cloth.
70%, yep.
Yeah, I used to have some green shade cloth, but I also had some native Australian orchids, and they weren't flowering.
Uh-huh.
And someone told me that, oh, probably because of the green shade cloth. So I changed to beige the next season. My orchids flowered.
Okay, and the important thing is we often talk about shade cloth for tomatoes. You need lots of light because it's a flowering plant and a fruiting plant, so you need a 50% shade, whereas your things like ferns need a little bit more protection. That's why that's 70%. Listen, moving on, so many things I need to ask you, and there's questions coming in. Deb, we've got questions coming in, or you want questions?
Yep. Oh, well, if you've got a question for Wayne, you better jump in quickly on 1-300-222-891. Julie does ask Wayne how to go about joining the Fern Society.
We have our meetings the last Friday of the month, and we're at the Maltese Guild Hall, 6 Jean Street, Beverley.
Yes.
And what time is that?
7:30. 7 o'clock, we've normally got some members there that may be selling some ferns.
Okay, and Frosty says, how do you kill mould in a fern garden without killing the plants?
The touchy one. Rather than sprays, it might be a little bit finicky, but I think you've just got to scrape around and just pick it off as best you can.
Maybe a brush with a little bit of a bleach, would that work?
It probably would. You might be able to try a little bit of methylated spirits and water. That might help it a little bit, knock it back on the head.
Yes, and you can buy proprietary materials now that are very effective in stopping mould and moss and things like that. It's rather expensive, but very, very effective and can be used on things like any of your furniture.
You don't want to be spraying anything because it'll drift over onto your fern.
Don't put it under the leaves, no. Okay, righto. Listen, come back now to potting mixes. You, as you say, you buy one in from a garden centre and they've got it growing in a special kind of a potting mix simply because they want it to grow quickly and look good when you buy it. When you take it home and probably you want to repot it into a bigger pot but not too big a pot, what kind of potting mix would you use?
Oh, I use a premium potting mix to which I add 50% orchid bark. That is part of opening the soil up so when you water, the water doesn't sit in the pot.
Now, for somebody
and
who's not...
And to that, I add a handful of horticultural charcoal.
The orchid bark, some people think, chunky pieces of orchid bark, 2 or 3 centimetres wide. Just tell us what an orchid bark is for potting.
Probably you can get various sizes, 5, 10 or 15 mil. I use between 10 and 15 mil.
15 mil.
So bags of that.
So we're looking at something the size of a fingernail.
Yep.
Okay, and you just mix that up with your potting mix?
That's all, yep. And there's other mixes you can use. You can use milled pine bark, fern fibre, which is very hard to get in South Australia, peat moss, of course, river sand. They're all mixes to the individual, what you think, what you've tried. If you had success with it, you stick to it.
Stay with it, yeah. Okay. So it's repotting time for all kind of plants, but particularly ferns. If you're going to repot, you can use the right potting mix, with the one with the little ticks down the side of the box, of the bag. But fertiliser, do you, if you're going to buy a quality one, I suppose the fertiliser is already there. But if you're going to add fertiliser when you're repotting, doing it yourself or during the growing season, what kind of a fertiliser is best for a fern?
When I'm repotting, I'll either use Rapid Razor, Dynamic Lifter, Charlie Carp pellets, and I'll mix, say, a spoonful of that in with the potting mix. I'll also mix in crushed up cow manure. That's to start it off. When I'm first watering, I use sea salt for the first couple of waterings to get the roots going a little bit.
Yep.
And then I'll move on to Charlie Carp, Nitrosol, Power Feed, whichever ones. I try to mix them up. I try not to stick to the same ones all the time.
Okay. Now what you're talking about, okay, we're talking about proprietary names, and you've listed a number of them, and we're not endorsing any particular one, but there is a big range out there. And I suppose what we're talking about, Wayne, is soft materials, soft organic, isn't it, rather than the harsh, if a granulated fertiliser is basically salts, and you put that on, you burn the roots of the plants, whereas what you're talking about is soft materials, which are organic, and break down and last a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what you want. You want to be able to give the plant its nutrients between September and April. That's their growing optimum time. And then when it comes to April through to September, the winter time, there's not a lot of growth. So you don't really worry about fertilising through that stage. So and you can also use your spray on ones for the leaf foliage.
Absolutely,
which does help them.
Tell us why more is not better.
They don't like strong mixes of fertilizer. If you read the instructions, they'll tell you 1 capful to 10 liters of water. Some people I know go stronger, but it's part of the plant that you don't want to be too strong with your fertiliser with it. So it's a gentle mix rather than a strong mix.
We've got a hot, dry summer coming our way, and I'm going to be running a program trying to encourage people to start using or make more use of soil wetting materials, things which will, when you water, it distributes the water evenly through the root system. Your thoughts on using soil wetters with ferns?
Just be careful with them that you don't use too much in your pot. I've been caught out where I've used too much of the soil wetter and it become a bog. So it's trial and error that you use maybe just a teaspoonful to start with on some of your plants in your mixes and see how you go with that. But certainly if the summers are going to be hotter, we need to be looking at alternative ways to water the plants.
Excellent. We are talking to Wayne Richards. He is president of the South Australian Fern Society. We'll come back and hear more from him in just a moment.
Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Our special guest is Wayne Richards, president of the SA Fern Society. Wayne, on the text line, Rachel from Victor Harbour says, I use worm juice from my worm farm on my ferns and they love it. So that's one thing. And this texter says, to remove mould and mildew, use either vinegar or bicarb soda. I've just successfully removed it. So I don't know what that actually applies to with ferns.
Yeah, if you've got mould on your containers, that's the problem. And certainly, a good old bicarb fixes a lot of things.
It's the only thing I use, bicarb and vinegar, that's it.
Yeah, and vinegar. Yeah, I mean, vinegar's just a mild acid, so many kind of things like that. Wayne, we've got our ferns and we've got them growing and repotted and fertilised and they're looking good. But as we mentioned, it's going to be, I think, a warm, probably a hot and dry summer. Let's talk a little bit about watering ferns. And you mentioned it's very easy to overwater ferns because of their fairly shallow root system. But let's take a look at how you water your ferns, and maybe we start by looking at, should you soak, when you're watering, should you use a water wand and water over the top, or is it better to dunk the whole container, presuming it's in a container, dunk the whole thing in a container and soak it that way?
I've just gone through the process of, I've got over 100 hanging baskets, so I've been going through and dunking each one of them for 10 or 15 minutes and then hang them up to drain and go through the whole process October each year to get them through the growing season.
That's important. So you've got them there and you're taking the whole container down and dunking it into a fairly large container.
That's right.
And presumably you've got a few little elixirs there, so things like soil wetters and your fertilisers mixed up?
Yep, that all goes in there. And when you dunk your plant in the solution, you'll start to see the bubble start to coming through, so the water, your mix is starting to eventually go right through. And as I said, it takes about about 10 or 15 minutes, and then you eventually see that those bubbles have stopped. So then that's when you take it out, hang it up, and go through the process with the next plant.
Otherwise, if you're using, say, a watering wand, you just can water over the top?
Yeah. I've got a spray system in my little fern house, so I'll turn that on. I might turn it on about 9 o'clock in the morning. I'll give it maybe 3 or 4 minutes, depending on the weather. If it's going to be 40 degrees, I might go out there a couple times during the day and just turn it on for a minute just to create that little bit of humidity and then turn it off again and way I go.
So this is a misting system, or is it a fogging system?
It's a misting system.
Misting system. So you've got little pipes coming around where you're growing your plants, and you've got these little emitters, and they squirt out little nice little sprays of water.
Yep.
And is that, are you watering the plants, or are you just creating coolness and cooling down the plants?
Well, the plants are getting watered. I have to check them fairly regularly because there's so many in there. It doesn't take much for one plant to grow, and then that will stop the water from reaching the next plant. So I quite regularly go around with the hose as well, and I water each individual plant.
Wayne, Derek on the text line asks about staghorn or elk horn, not sure which. Frond forks have brown tips. The back leaves are going strong. Is Derek underwatering? Is something eating them? It's just the outer layer, not right through the frond. And what does he need to do?
If the tips on the end are brown, that's probably the fern spore that's growing on there.
On the back of it.
Yes, that's how they reproduce.
Okay, and there's a little caterpillar that eats the spore too, isn't that can be a bit of a problem.
Yeah, staghorn beetle.
Arthur says there's a begonia and fern show next Saturday at Clemsy Community Hall, starts at 10 o'clock.
That's right, I was going to mention that, someone's already jumped in. Yeah, so there'll be plenty of begonias, there'll be plenty of ferns. The good thing about the ferns is that they're the ferns that you won't see in the normal nurseries.
That's right.
These are ferns that members have been able to collect over the years because they've been able to go up to Queensland, New South Wales, do all their little tours and been able to bring ferns back, which you can't do now because of the quarantine situations.
And this is all in the Clemsy Community Hall next weekend, was it?
That's right, yes.
Just a one day?
10 o'clock till 3 o'clock, yes.
Yeah, and you'll have begonias on one side, ferns on the other side, and everybody rushes into their favourites and then they start mixing, and it's a very, very exciting kind of a day.
Yeah, it is, it is. It's good just to see all the lush green plants.
And the important thing is the people that are there selling the plants know they're ferns, they're Wayne Richards clones, or whether it's a begonia, and so you can just learn so much from those
That's where you pick up your information, John.
Yes. Wayne, thank you very much for your contribution this morning. As I say, sometimes I get a bit enthusiastic and I keep on butting in, but thank you very much for your wonderful information.
It's part of your job, isn't it?
Thank you, Wayne.
No worries, Deb.
Thanks. Wayne Richards, you can see him next weekend, president of the South Australian Fern Society. We'll give the last word on ferns to Daisy. Says, I have hare's foot ferns growing in Woodside under a veranda where it gets cold during winter and it's thriving in wire baskets. I pull out the old fronds each year, very easy to grow. Thanks very much for that. We would like to go talk back gardening with you. So if you've got a question, call in now, 1300 222 891. John is here to talk to you, and Sue is in McLaren Vale. Now, Sue, good morning. Tell us about your issue.
I've got a barrel cactus and it's growing pups. I want to know, how do I get the pups off the barrel cactus so I can grow some more?
Oh, how big are they? How are the little pups?
Oh, they're about 3 inches wide.
Righto. Lots of them?
I've got two. Well, that's enough.
You can start your own little garden centre, maybe.
Oh, no.
Look, they're very, very easy. Just get a very, very sharp knife. Be very, very careful if it's sharp that you don't cut yourself. And you'll find where the little pups are joined to the stem. Try and take just a little whisker of the stem with the pup. And you can just take them off. The cactus itself will repair itself fairly quickly. Just if you've got them growing all around the stem, don't ring bark the stem, otherwise on a hot day you might find it might collapse on you. But just be selective, but take as many as you want. And the important thing is don't drown them in the first couple of weeks. If you have a very, very open mix, probably just get some sand, coarse washed sand, and maybe put no more than about 10% of a little bit of peat moss or something like that, the cocoa peat. And all you need to do is just rest the pup on top of the material that you've got there, and so that it's just probably half a centimetre, a quarter of a centimetre is buried. And then be very careful. Rather than sort of water it with a watering wand, I'd use a misting bottle and just mist. The material you've got is moist to start with, so not soggy wet, just moist. Put your pup on top of it, mist it down, and put it somewhere out of the wind, somewhere where it's getting very good light but no direct sun, and you'll be surprised at how many little pups you'll have.
Would I use some, say, tongs to hold on to it to cut it off, because they're very prickly?
That's your problem.
Good gardening gloves. Good solid leather gardening gloves, Sue. I'd recommend that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Sue. Good luck with that. Hope you have lots of new cactus plants. Margaret is in Mount Barker on succulents still. And Margaret, you've got succulents at the base of your apricot tree.
Yes, I do. And last year the apricot tree didn't fruit, and it doesn't look like we're going to get fruit this year either. And we're worried that it's because of what we're growing at the bottom.
Suckers. You've got lots of sucker growth there, is that right?
Yes.
Succulents. Oh, is it?
No, I would presume. Is it succulents or suckers?
No, succulents.
So succulents. Plants. Okay, well, that's different. Yeah, well... that's not good, because if they're growing presumably up close to the trunk?
They are.
Yeah. You'll need to clear anything that's growing around for probably about 30 centimetres around the trunk of your apricot. Apricot trees are very susceptible to collar rot. It's a fungus, and it'll rot the bark, and once that does, in fact, you may already be starting to see the beginning of the decline. It won't happen overnight. It'll happen slowly. So get the succulents away. And keep the base of your tree, your apricot tree, as dry as possible.
Okay. All right. Well, my husband will be very happy because he's the one who said that's what the problem was.
Okay. Tough bananas there, Mark.
Yeah.
Thanks, Margaret. Okay. Appreciate it. We are Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb. The number is 1-300-222-891. Later in the program, we'll be talking about a great new soil citizen science project happening in the Murraylands and Riverland, and I'll be giving away two October ABC Gardening Australia magazines.
Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
If you would like to speak to John, call in now on 1-300-222-891. Rosalind in Glenside has done that. Good morning, Rosalind.
Good morning.
You've got some banana plants. Tell us what the problem is.
Well, it's not a problem with the banana plants, but I have a small backyard and the back fence is metal. It's about 2 metres high, and the banana plants are probably 2 to 3 feet away at the bottom. But as the leaves grow up, they're starting to touch the side of the fence. And the fence faces north, so it's going to get pretty hot. And I thought I might string a shade cloth along between two poles as a sort of a buffer between the fence and the bananas. And I'm just wondering, with the shade cloth, how high it should be up from the bottom. I don't need to have it touching the ground. And how far away from the fence, like 12 centimetres from the fence or a bit further away.
So how far is the banana plants from the fence?
Well, at the base where they come up in their trunk, yes, probably 2 feet, 3 feet. There are three different plants.
Okay, so they're fairly close, and so the leaves are actually coming across. Yeah, bananas.
Yeah, it's hot.
Yeah, okay. And, I mean, they are very, very tough plants, and they're exposed to pretty hot temperatures where they come from in Queensland and northern New South Wales and Darwin, of course. But in that situation, if you want to do something, yes, use a shade cloth. Use heat-absorbing colours such as white or beige. Stay away from black. And certainly you don't need to have it covered. All you need to do is basically from about two-thirds, if you come up, say, two-thirds of the height of the fence, you can start your shade at that area, and then whatever is the height of your bananas, maybe you may become another metre above the fence line. So you've probably got a strip, it might be 2 metres at the most wide, just protecting that area. You'll need some pretty strong kind of
poles
to hold it up, but I think you'll find that the leaves, of course, will brush against the shade and they'll be damaged during the wind. Do anything you can to reduce the wind. This is one of the Achilles' heel of bananas, of course, is wind, and if you can reduce the effect of the wind, you reduce the damage to the fronds, and hopefully that overcomes that particular problem.
And should the shade cloth be one that you can sort of see through, very open weave, or really close that you can't see?
Oh, no, I'd be using 50%. I mean, right, if you've got 70%, that's okay. But, you want to make sure that the wind can actually blow through. The material. Mm. Otherwise, it acts as a physical barrier, and it'll try and blow itself over, whereas if the wind can pass through, it helps aerate the leaves of the banana anyway.
It's a pretty sheltered corner, so there's not a lot of wind. And fertiliser for the bananas, what should I give them?
A little bit often, mainly high nitrogen. But if you buy a fertiliser specifically for fruit trees, that will contain all of the elements. The important thing is with bananas, make sure you've got a good balance of nitrogen, phosphorus, potash and your trace elements in South Australia. And I think if you're using ideally an organic fertiliser, get into the habit of using organic fertilisers in springtime and in autumn, and maybe topping it up with liquid organic fertiliser on a monthly basis during the growing season.
All right. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for the call, Rosalind. Appreciate it. On 1300 222 891. Sally in McGill has rung through about her passion fruit vine. Good morning, Sally.
Morning. I've got a two-year-old passion fruit growing against a rainwater tank, and it's covered in flowers. It looks really healthy, but they're dropping off. They're not setting at all.
It's probably because it's immature, and I think you'll find that after another 12 months, maybe a bit longer, depending on how much vigour there's there, you've got growth hormones, and they are just saying we want to grow rather than set flowers. The best thing you can do is, on a day like today, get your hedge clippers and clip the ends of the fronds. Presumably you've got lots of branches or lots of tendrils, and it's putting on good growth.
Lots of growth.
Right, just clip it all over. What you're doing is taking out the tip growth. The tips are loaded with growth hormone, and if they take the tips off, you reduce the growth hormones, and it says, oh, maybe we better start flowering. Mm. And not only flower, we might actually send you some fruit as well.
Oh, that'd be nice.
That would be lovely. I was getting all excited with the flowers, and then
Isn't it so frustrating? You think, butler, we're going to have passion fruit this season, and it doesn't happen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sally, for calling in. And probably this texter is feeling pretty unhappy. He says, my 7-year-old banana passion fruit never fruited, was healthy looking 2 weeks ago. Now it's all dead. Brown leaves curling up, one sad-looking fruit left, the rest is dead. I can't believe it.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, sorry to hear that. Thomas is in Harndorf. Now, what fruit tree have you got, Thomas?
Santa Rosa plum tree.
Okay, and what's the problem?
So I went overseas for work about a month ago, and it was blossoming and flowering and all that stuff, and now I've come home, and there's no leaves or anything on it.
Did they drop quickly?
I'm not sure. I was away. So, yeah, I'm not exactly sure what's happened. But, yeah, it's not looking too good. And I've got a Satsuma plum a few metres away from it, and it's completely healthy. It's got fruit on it and heaps of leaves.
All right. So you've got good growth to start with, and all of a sudden the leaves have disappeared and on that one and not around it. Something's happened in the soil. How old is that tree?
Maybe 5 or 6 years.
Right. And is it healthy?
Yeah, it is, yep.
Yeah, okay. So something's happened in the soil, and it's a bit of a mystery if the ones next to it are okay. My first reaction would be, first thing is, at this time of the year, people are complaining that leaves on their fruit trees and things like that are dropping. It's because they put on too much fertilizer, a granular fertilizer, into dry soil, and that will sort of make it drop the leaves. The next thing is, has it dried out? And I can only assume that the soil around the root system, it may be the root system is not very extensive even after 5 years, and while you're away, and bearing in mind it's been a very, very, very dry start to spring, about 50% below average in September. We've had about less than 10 millimetres for October. So the ground in many gardens is dry. Now's the time you should be starting to water, and water seriously. I would be getting a spade or a trowel and going down into the root system, go down about 30 centimetres, and you might be surprised at just how dry the ground is at that area. If that is what you find, that's your problem.
Okay. Sounds good.
Get water. Get investigating and get watering, Thomas. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
I just need to reinforce. The season has changed, and okay, it has been mild, lovely growing conditions temperature-wise, but the soil is now drying out very rapidly. If you get a spade and go down 20 centimetres, you might be surprised at just how little moisture there is. Now's the time to fill up the subsoil and fill up the soil again. If you let it dry out, and you'll lose the trees and the shrubs will get a setback, And then when you water it, it'll take probably another week or so to recover before it gets going again. Whereas it's growing beautifully at the moment. Keep them growing and you'll have a lovely garden by the time summer comes.
Compost, mulch, water.
Well said, yes. Deb. Well said.
We're talking about gardening. We're going to hear about a fantastic new citizen science soil project that's happening in the Riverland and Murraylands next. If you've not won anything from ABC Radio Adelaide in the last month and you'd like to win yourself a couple, or one in fact, of two ABC Gardening Australia magazines we have to give away, call through on 1300 222 891.
Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hardly a Talk Back Gardening program goes by without a question or a comment on healthy soil. But how do you know if your soil is healthy? Because what's happening is happening beneath the ground. You can't see it. A good start might be to take part in a citizens' science program which is being organised by the Murraylands and the Riverland Landscape Board. And Extension Officer for Soils is Barry Williams. Good morning to the program, Barry, and welcome to Talk Back Gardening.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Deb. How are you this morning?
So, you've got these little soil health kits, and they're available for either for gardeners or for farmers or for people that are out there in the bush for testing the health of the soil. Could you just tell us the principle of what it's all about?
It's for the Riverland and Murraylands Landscape Board region. They basically will get people to that are interested in the project participating to register for free on our on the Murraylands Riverland Landscape Board website.
Yes.
And we'll send them out a CO2 burst kit, which contains two plastic jars, two foil packs for the CO2 burst panels, a colour chart, and a pipette.
So let's pause there. Okay. You've got a kit, and it's got two jars, which presumably you put soil in. Yeah, you've got a colour chart. And what was the other factor you had there?
We've got a pipette, so we actually can put a bit of water in, because as you were just saying before, the soils are pretty dry.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Righto, so that's the kit, or is there something else that goes with it?
No, that's the whole kit that will be sent out, and instructions, obviously, of yes. what to do. The jars will have a indicator level on them, and the participants will go to two different sites on their property, one with a good healthy soil and one with a poorer health soil, or like on a farm they might go to a spot that's got cover crops or crops in, and an area that they might be using for containing sheep or something like that.
All right. Okay.
Or a horse yard.
Right.
And then you fill your two jars up with to the line that will be indicated on the jar. Possibly add some water if there hasn't been any rain for a bit. As per instruction, you put the CO2 burst panel, that's in the silver foil, one to each jar. Close the lid. Then close the lid after 24 hours. You compare the panel to the chart. Take a photo of it for us, and send it back to us. As per instruction.
All right, but that little colour chart, people could actually just use the colour chart and look at it a bit like sort of a soil testing kit.
Yes, like that, or even like a paint chart, perhaps, even like for a wall.
All right.
Like that, so it gives you different colour graduations. It goes from a purple colour, just says low CO2 being respired in the soil, to a yellowy green colour, which means a high CO2 is being respired.
Right, so, okay. So on one side we've got the kit with the jars and the colour and a little pipette and a little panel that's all mixed up, and the end result is you get something that has got a colour. Are you actually measuring? Are you measuring the carbon in the soil or the microbes?
We're measuring both, in a way. What's happening, the microbes are breaking down organic matter. With a plant, say photosynthesize, so they use the sunlight and CO2, they make sugars, and they push sugars down to help the plant grow, and they push sugars down through the roots. The sugars that are through the roots, the microbes use that to feed themselves, and as they're breaking that down, CO2 is released. So the microbes will also break down organic matter that's within the soil and also release, some microbes will go to the organic matter and release the CO2 from that.
When we talk about soil health, then, we're talking about two things. One is the amount of carbon in the soil, and yes, the other one is the amount of microbes that gobble up the carbon.
That's correct.
Aha. Mm. Uh-huh. So what if you do your test and it says it's not healthy, what's the problem? What's missing? Is it the carbon that's missing or the microbes?
Could be both.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That's why we'd have to probably go and investigate a bit more.
It would be interesting then. Say somebody's got a nice vegetable patch and they fill one of the jars with the soil that comes out of their tomato patch and then goes somewhere, say, under their fruit trees, under their citrus trees, which don't get mulched and then don't get looked after, and compare one with the other.
Yeah, that's what they do.
Yes.
And you'd see, usually your garden stuff should have like a fair bit of organic matter that's broken down and been looked after well.
That's fascinating. This is for the Murraylands and Riverland area. What's the likelihood that this concept might take up and might be spread across South Australia through the landscape boards?
I haven't really spoken to any out of the landscape boards about this part yet.
It's probably that's right. I'm going to talk to John Schultz, a former person in charge of the environmental areas in a couple of weeks' time, so we might come back and put that one on hold for John
Schultz.
Yeah,
we'll do that. But right now, if you're in the Murraylands or the Riverland area, you can register online at the landscape board there. And as you said, Barry, you can get your allocations, and I think you'll keep giving them out until all the soil tests are gone.
Yes.
And when are you going to have the results of the project?
I think we're aiming to put some of the results out on the World Soils Day, so the 4th of December, I think it is.
Right, we'll have to check back in.
All right, so we can keep in touch with you and we can get some feedback as to what you're finding out there. But in the meantime, just remind us, if people want to get involved, where do they go?
To the Murraylands and Riverland Landscape Board website and just register for free on there.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with it. Sounds very interesting, Barry. And on the text line, Matt from Angle Vale is saying, well, we don't live there. How can we get hold of one of these kits? So at the moment, we'll find out. Watch this space. Yeah.
The other thing is that the Murraylands Riverland Landscape Board did a couple of years ago, they did Soil Your Undies project, where they had some cotton Y fronts and they buried them in the soil.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can actually see how the microbes, how the fungi have broken down the cotton. Like we've had some that was in a compost heap. All that was left was the elastine on the top. Another one was planted in another paddock somewhere and hadn't broken down at all. Like you could just wash them and probably rewear them.
So that was saying there aren't microbes in that particular area because otherwise they'd be eaten away.
Yeah.
Okay. It could have been the microbes. Also, it could have been too dry as well. Like the microbes, they go to the ebb and flow during a season. So they'll be high one part of the season, they'll drop off and they'll just ebb and flow
Yeah, no, I think it's good that we can learn to sort of start testing and understanding what's happening in the soil and more about that in the future programs.
Yes, Barry, well, thank you very much for joining us and good luck with the project.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Barry Williams, Soil Extension Officer with the Murraylands and Riverland Landscape Board. Almost out of time for Talk Back Gardening. Now, John, you've got the Good Gardening newsletter. If you haven't already signed up for it, you just go in and you give your email address and then like magic, it will arrive in your email letterbox every Friday morning. But you've had some issues around email changes.
The email, of course, is absolutely free and it's put together by two part-time people. I do the writing and my colleague Steve Swan actually does the layout. But there are problems with distribution. There's well over 10,000 subscribers and people want to change their email email address. And there's problems with Internode at the moment, and I'm not too sure what's going wrong, but there's major problems there. And we're being inundated with people saying, can you change our email, the email address? And as I say, there's only Steve and I. We don't, it's free. We can't afford an administrator. So Steve has come to the conclusion that at the end of the newsletter, right at the very end of the newsletter, you can do it yourself. You just fill in the box, fill in the details, and you can change your address. There's another little box if you want to send the email to a friend, or if you want to subscribe. Well, there's a number of little boxes there. Go right to the end of the newsletter and take a look at and you can administer and look after it. It's a free newsletter, yeah, between the ABC and the news and Talkback Gardening.
You're pretty busy already. So just go to, if you do need to change your email, it's just easy. Go to the end of the newsletter and change it yourself, and it will arrive to that new address the following Friday morning. John, we're out of time for Talkback Gardening. It flies so quickly every Saturday. What are you doing this weekend?
Well, I'm going to buy my first tomato for the season.
Ooh.
And it'll be a little short tomato, probably be a first prize, one that grows in a container rather than one you have to stake, because I've got a courtyard. Anyway, till next week, good gardening.